thing that has been happening in East Ministry, we've been hitting it from different things, book reviews yesterday morning and whatever. It seems like we kind of circle in once in a while from places where you are in ministry, and that's okay. I'd like to just kick us off with things, but if you wind up somewhere else, that's fine. If I lose interest totally, I'll leave and you keep on, whatever. And the area that I wanted to work on this morning was that of gifts and ministry. And I think I'd like to say some things about it, talk about them with you, and then have you try, at the end of that time, to think that through for yourself with a few other people, and then see whether that raises any more questions. So what we'll do is spend a little time talking about the business of using our gifts in ministry, then a little bit of time where you can talk with a couple of other people about what that might mean to you, and then a little time back seeing if there's anything we need to sort of say or hear or talk about after that, okay? Just a little. The reason it seems important to talk about gifts first is that that's an area that everybody has a different comment to make about it, and I'd like to have us make a lot of those comments to each other. For me, the starting point is that ministry should not always start with the need, but should often start with the person. If you think about it, very, very frequently the way the church talks about ministry is to hold out needs. These kinds of activities need to be done. These kind of positions need to be filled. This kind of task is very, very important. And the whole emphasis is on the needs. And then we kind of go out and we try to get people to fulfill those needs. A congregation will adopt a program. It's a very important program in that neighborhood. And that will create needs for a bunch of different kinds of people. And then we'll go out, and I've done a lot of that squeezing people into that, well, I really, you know, don't fit that. Well, you sort of fit that kind of thing. It got kind of refreshing to me to begin to realize you can go at ministry the other way around, and that is to start with the people and to say the job is to help those people identify their gifts and use those gifts in ministry. So that's kind of where I'm coming from when I start to talk about gifts. It's a way of starting to say, what kind of gifts do I have, and how can those be used in ministry? And the best way I can talk about gifts is just to give some loosely strung together illustrations, stories, or whatever. One is just about the basic attitude in the first place. I want to tell you about a college friend of mine who could do everything. He was a championship debater. He was a basketball star. He was a track star. He got straight A's, much to the consternation of the props, by the way, because he didn't have to listen and still could get straight A's. So they tried to invent ways, practically, for him to fail a test or something. And he just really tops in all kinds of ways. He went out with girls, like all of us did, whenever we could. And the relationship would usually last about two dates. And me, ever the research person, I had occasion once to go out with a young lady that he had just gone out with twice. And, of course, I ask, well, you know, what's the deal? And she said, well, the only problem with him is that he thinks he's God's gift to women. Well, I tell you about him, same tell you about me. Because I was the other way around. When I got on the phone, I was so awed that the young lady was willing to talk with me in the first place that I made that very clear how lucky I was that she was on the phone talking with me. And if perchance I did get a date with her, I spent the evening really talking about what a great person she was, and really, you know, how lucky I was to be in her company as somebody like me. Until the lady who has since become my wife said to me one night, Roy,
Have you ever thought what an insult it is to me that you're all I could get? I mean, if I was really as bad as I was saying and she was as good as I was saying, what was she doing with me? And I guess I kind of like that little illustration because I've done lots of retreats in 5 years and I find lots of Christians who spend their time making sure that they let everybody know how little they have to offer. We used to do a little exercise when we'd start a retreat. And you draw a little shield, and you put on the shield something about your name, something else, and two little pieces of that were, what do you need from this group, and what do you have to offer this group? And you know what would happen? People would kind of share this, and the thing about need, oh, I need this, and I need this from this group, and I need this from this group, and I need this. Well, what do you have to offer this? Oh, I have nothing to offer. I'm just here out of my need. I think there are a bunch of reasons for that. Obviously, one is psychological. If I don't offer, I don't run any risks. You know, if I hold back, I don't stand a chance of getting myself out there on a limb and have it cut off. I notice that for me about groups. I'm very careful, very slow to offer myself because then I'm not taking chances. I'm being very, very cautious. That's true in all of life. The less I offer, the less risk I run. So I think that's one reason. I think another one that builds on top of that for Christians, and especially, I haven't worked with lots of other Christians, but I know it's true of Lutherans, that we've misapplied some theology. You know, we take probably the cardinal doctrine of the Lutheran religion and misapply it. The cardinal one, that when I stand before God to ask God's forgiveness, I have nothing to offer as the reason he should forgive me, right? I mean, this is justification by grace. I can't say to God, well, forgive me because I won't do it again. That's a dangerous promise. I can't say, well, forgive me because I'm better than somebody else anyway. what does that have to do with it? I can't say, forgive me because I did the best I could. You know, I'm better not say that either. I say to God, I have no reason to offer that you should forgive me. And God, as act of pure grace, no reason at all in me, forgives me. But that's for forgiveness. We take that doctrine that I have no reason to offer God for my forgiveness and go around saying I have nothing to offer, period. You know, that sounds so humble. You know, it sounds so good that I have nothing to offer. And of course, wipe out the doctrine of creation. You know, now I'm back to my little story. I think a lot of Christians insult God. You know, if you have nothing to offer, whose fault is that? You know, who's the one that made you? Bad job? Is that what you're trying to say?
Reject.
Yeah, right. most of you have heard the Eastern saying, God doesn't make junk. You know, and yet we walk around often implying that he did. You know, this is, after all, everybody else is this, everybody else is this, but I guess I'm kind of a second run of the mill kind of thing. Now, I'm not trying to aim us at that we're supposed to go around with, God's gift to women. I'm just saying we have really, with a vengeance, applied the idea of nothing to offer, and it sounds so good. You know, that's the problem. It sounds so humble to say, I have nothing to offer. I think it takes a little work to start looking at who you are. Okay, that's one thing. Just attitude, first of all. I don't think we're going to get very far in talking about gifts and ministry if I'm psychologically and theologically disposed to claim I don't have any. If that's my operating stance, we may as well forget the rest of the discussion. So I'm first of all asking us to accept the fact that maybe God made somebody who was okay. Gordon Cosby says three things about that I really like. He says, first of all, it is important for me to take a look at what God created. You know, that's a good project. What did God make when I was born? You know, what was the result of God's creation. I think one of the reasons Genesis is in the Bible is not just to give people a fun time arguing about things or how the Bible was put together, but to show how we were created. All the rest of the world, you know, God is mass production. Detroit, let there be trees, roll them off. You know, the world's covered with trees. Let there be fish, let there be all this. Comes time for a human being, makes one, you know? And guess what? We made the second one different, you know? Totally different. And the third one wasn't like the first two. And the fourth one wasn't like the first three, and we can go right on down to you. You know, that's it. I like kind of realizing that when I die, there's going to be a vacancy. You know, you don't fill that. That's going to be a loss. That's what God created. And when I'm looking for what did God... I did a little exercise once with a group of people, and it was tough for them at first. I said, get in little groups and say, what did the world get when God gave it you? You know, what did the world get? One guy said, well, it shows God has a great sense of humor. It was funny because that was a group, a lot of these were kids and a lot of these kind of groups. And the kids really could tie into that. But the adults were, you know, they would say, well, this is what God got and this is what God made, you know, and all that. The adults really holding back, you know, really hard for them to take some looks at that. Okay, that's one kind of area of talking about gifts. Oh, let me add on with Cosby. First of all, God made me. You know, what did God create? Then he goes on to say, you can really think about sin that way, that the result of sin, this separation from God, is that that original gift gets distorted. It gets messed up, it gets hemmed in by fear, by all kinds of things, and it gets all bent out of shape. And that's why God bought back his gifts. You know, that's why God had to get on with the project of saving the original creation that you represent. I understand that kind of talk because when I lived in D.C., the big fad, still is, was to restore old houses. We moved into a restored house. Well, what happens? In a restored house, what you have is a beautiful creation, something that somebody put a lot of very intricate work into 100 years ago. Beautiful houses. Except that in the interim, they've turned into tenements, they've turned into rooming houses, they've been totally distorted. You know, just a colossal disaster. All right, here comes an eager-eyed young couple, and they buy the house. That's the first step. They put that piece of money into this property. And then begins the work, you know, as they restore it to all the beauty that it once had. And Cosby says we can look at the whole creation, redemption, sanctification. In much the same way. You know, that God is working on the people he created. Buys them back, Holy Spirit in me. Look at some of the language. The God who breathed into, the God who said, let light appear, has breathed into our hearts to give knowledge of Jesus Christ. It's creation talk. You know, it's like repeating the creation. You know, God's back at work in me. So I like to think of me that way. You know, that the original that God made, God is back at work in. And he's still working on it. Okay, now a second whole area. I'm getting nervous about talking too much, but I want to get these out and let you talk over. Okay. Second whole area is how I receive the things that are going on in my life. If one thing is to look at who I am when I talk about gifts, the second is to talk about how I receive what's going on. My illustration here has to do with fatherhood. For a long time, fatherhood was really a disaster for me because I was so convinced I was such a lousy one. I wasn't the all-American father, you know, out there hit the old ball around, all that kind of stuff. And I was pretty concerned about the fact that I probably wasn't doing it right with my son. And then I would read the columns and the books and they would tell you what a good father does, and then I'd really be messed up, you know, because I could really see what I wasn't doing. And then, as I was working through a lot of this gift stuff, it began to occur to me, how did I get to be a father? And again, if I'm a believer, what do I believe about my being a father? I believe that God was behind that. And if I believe that, why did God let me be a father? It wasn't to mess up my life. It was a gift. Okay, now, if fatherhood is a gift, you know, what's the first, I always like to ask this, what's the first requirement when you receive a gift? What's required of you?
Gratitude.
Gratitude, yeah?
Take it.
Take it? I think one of the biggest is to enjoy it. You know, that's why the person gave it to you. That's why when you open up and see that awful tie, you're smiling, you know. You are required to enjoy that gift. I mean, that's the job, is to enjoy it. And so that began to open up a whole new thing. It said, Roy, the first step in being a father is to enjoy that. That's a gift. That's a really neat part of your life. Well, I had to change a few things. Instead of worrying about whether or not I could throw the ball around, there were a lot of things I liked to do. And instead of worrying all the time about not being home, that kind of things, I began to ask, hey, I'm missing out on something. You know, it's not my son needs me. It's I'm blowing something. I got this neat gift that I'm not getting enough chance to enjoy. And it was quite a turnaround for me. I don't know how significant it would be for others, but it was big for me to begin to get into enjoying being a father. For my sake. You know, not for my son's sake, for my sake. And I made a very interesting discovery about him in the process. That kind of freed him up. He didn't have to be the all-American kid either. We could kind of negotiate what we enjoy. And he was kind of free to be a son, you know, as he saw. So that's kind of a second whole area. How do, out of that one, if out of the first area came the question, I do need to look at who I am and see who's there, the second one came, can I receive this with thanksgiving? In other words, can I receive this part of my life with thanksgiving? And not to automatically say yes, as a kind of a theological statement. To work at it, to see if I can. And I would suggest that one possibility for looking at that James passage, do not resent your troubles as outsiders. I'm in a modern translation here. Do not resent your troubles as outsiders, but welcome them as friends. The last thing in the world I would want to be with that is glib. As though, oh wow, you know, you can always just say about this trouble, that thing, great, neat, whatever. But I think the struggle that a Christian does have is taking the pieces of your life and working on them to accept them with thanksgiving. Which leads me to tell this one little story that I told in the book discussion group yesterday afternoon about a lady who really discovered her gift that way. She became known as an educator of the mentally retarded. People would come to town to see her teaching methods in the Sunday School for the Retarded that we had in Washington, D.C. There's a movie now out. It's called Mrs. Meyer on Sunday Morning or something like that. Anyhow, she really is the neatest teacher that you could find because she does it so beautifully with the kids. How did she get to be that? Didn't go to college. She didn't have a degree in learning disabilities or anything like that. She simply had an overwhelming desire that her two mentally retarded children be able to understand the Sunday school lesson. She began to receive that mental retardation of her children as friend, instead of fighting it, resisting it, to receive it. And she began to say to herself, well, who knows how to, you know, what needs to happen is translate. When they go to the regular Sunday school, they don't understand. Well, when people understand, you translate. Well, who knows how to translate? Somebody that knows both. I know both. I know my kids. I know this. And she began to translate. She did all, and it was every Sunday morning, I can honestly say it was exciting. I would get in and out of there with great regularity because she would use me. The beautiful thing about her as a Sunday school teacher, she never said, can you do something? She always tell me what you want me to do. I want you to stand over there in your robes because we're dealing with your robes this morning. All right. I always knew exactly what I was supposed to do. But let's take the story of old Simeon in the temple. How do I get across to my kids old? And I know what I'll do. I'll get old Mr. Schneider, the oldest man in the congregation, to sit in the middle of it, and they can feel his skin, they can touch his hair, they can do whatever they want. You talk about a beautiful scene. It's old Mr. Schneider with these kids around him. And guess what? He discovered his gift. I'm the oldest man in the congregation. Whenever you need old, call on me. And he, you know, he was very proud of his part. And the thing that hit me is with regularity, he was in and out of that Sunday school class. Okay. For her, identifying her gifts was not looking for super talents or something like that. It was receiving one of the dimensions of her life with thanksgiving. You know, it was saying, I want to deal with this. I want to deal with where it is. And I think God used that to show her she had a terrific talent. You know, that she had just a remarkable ability. I don't think she'd have ever discovered at any other time. Third area is just to say a word about Holy Spirit and gift. And then we'll let you talk about a minute. You can talk with each other. I think I've already set a little bit of the stage for how at least I understand Holy Spirit. And I don't want to imply that this morning we're going to come out with a nice rigid agreement on gifts. I can accept most people's understandings, and most people tend to be able to accept mine. I'm not that interested in narrowing down precisely what we mean. As I mentioned the other group too, I think human beings have such a tendency to want everything organized and narrowed down. You know, then we're all comfortable if it all fits. Somebody says if a committee had designed the heavens, all the stars would be in rows. I kind of like a little... I feel a little bit of chaos is a good place for God to be operative, you know. So you have a slightly different definition than I do, and I have a different understanding. I don't want to work that all out. I want to leave a little room for that to be okay. But around the Spirit and gifts, that a kind of third area is that the Spirit does indeed give me special callings and special abilities for special situations. I just don't see how I can believe that the Holy Spirit is greatly at work without being very open to looking for what is the Spirit doing here in my life. And as that begins to come out, I don't see that as setting a gift that may have very little to do with my nature versus a gift that has a lot to do with my nature. Again, I just don't see a need that we got to say it's one that one is a spiritual gift, the other is not a spiritual gift. That I'm trying to bounce between talking about the gifts. First of all, the gift of the Spirit is the Spirit's presence in my life. 1 Peter, each of us as good stewards of the grace of God must strive to use for the good of others the special gift he has received from God. If you begin to dig around in that section of 1 Peter, the first thing he is talking about is that the gift is the Spirit himself, that the Spirit is operative in my life, and I am to be very open to that. It isn't just the gift in kind of lowercase, you know, that I got a neat little identified gift and I clutch and hang on to that. I think that as I go through the years, what it means for me to be seeing gifts is changing all the time, because I think the Spirit is alive, you know, not locked in some kind of spot at where once I received the Spirit or once I was baptized or something like that. And that can lead to some very interesting things. It can lead to some very prosaic things. But that the way I understand most of the New Testament is that Paul was trying to keep most of those people in touch with each other. And when we have kind of longer retreats with congregations, one of the interesting things that always emerges is that somebody cannot accept somebody else's gift. It isn't that I struggle with mine. It's that I don't understand yours. If it's down to a trustee in one congregation saying, when I see the needs of this congregation, and he was thinking kind of physical property, I just can't accept her description of her gift. And that didn't sound too different from a lot of what's going on in Corinthians. You know, a lot of the, you say this gift is better, you say that gift is better. But what generally emerges from people who are trying very much to respond to the Spirit in their lives is that there's a hassle about yours, not mine, yours. I can believe the Spirit's working in me. I just have trouble with believing that that's in here. So they kind of, people usually talk about three little kind of guidelines for making it more possible for people to live with each other's gifts and for people's gifts to flower as opposed to being suffocated. One is that you don't judge the gifts. You know, somebody says, at this point, this is what I see. You don't say, well, that's very nice, however, that you judge it. You give feedback, you talk, but you don't judge it and try to decide, because who are you to say where the Spirit is with that person at that time? And that's just where it is. The second, that you not take control of somebody else's gift. This is the hardest part often for congregations. A lot of congregations interpret what I'm saying to mean, well, people should turn in their gifts and then we'll tell them what to do with them. And, you know, we did that once. We had people turn in what their gift was, and then our committee was going to assign that all. And I think the biggest problem with that is that it turns control of what that person is saying over to somebody else. I know that's why I hold back. You know, letting somebody know I have this interest, or I have this desire, or I maybe have this talent, or maybe have this ability. But then somebody else takes over and says, now you got to go to meetings, you know, or something like that, and that wasn't part of it. That's why those groups where people talk with each other, and the purpose of the rest of the group is not to take over that gift, but to help you as you try to follow the Spirit. In other words, they're there to help you clarify if you need that. They're there to help you do it, but they don't take over, okay? And the third comment usually made about using gifts among each other is pretty related to that, and that is that you don't insist that that gift be used for your need. In other words, again, this is often spoken to pastors or other leaders, that you don't say, well, that's really very neat that you have a concern for translating to your kids, but we have this terrific need for Sunday school teacher right now, and you could do that just as well there. You know, why don't you do that? This kind of, take my needs, and you can certainly present them. You can certainly say this is where it is. But, and this leads to kind of the point that always gets exciting, learning to say no so that your yes means something. We try to develop among people the ability to say no to requests for ministry, requests for that. Not fickleness, but to say you're responsible finally for your following of Jesus Christ. And I want you free to say no so that I can come and ask. You know, it's okay if I'm asking. If I know you are the kind of person who will think it through, ask if I can receive it with thanksgiving, look at it as a ministry, and if you can't, you'll say no. Then I'm free to ask. See, a lot of people turn into, they either want to control the whole thing, or they back off and say, well, we'll just go with volunteers. And they're very discouraged. There's no calling in that. There's no calling to this ministry, there's a calling to that. But the freedom to call and the freedom to respond with no have got to be there if gifts are going to emerge, because I have to be in charge of it. Okay, I'll stop with that. Does that give you anything you want to talk about before we put you in some other things?
I think what you're talking about first, confidence in yourself, right, to be able to give. And that's what I feel lots of times within myself and seem to see in others, is our insecurities and you know, why we aren't able to give, or why we think lowly of ourselves. And also lots of times humility is preached to us so heavily that we go to the opposite extreme. And I think that affects not only our giving but also our receiving, and that we don't deserve gifts. you know, as much as we don't have the ability to give.
Even like receiving a compliment, right?
Right, exactly.
How that messes us up. What do you do with it?
Because it's so easy for that to turn the ego and, you know, just let it blaze, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so to combat that then with buckets of humility. Mm-hmm. But that's maybe, you know, where to find that balance is delicate.
Where do we as parents also, how do I say this? You know, I think sometimes we as parents in the church expect certain things of our children, and we say, you know, you will sing in the choir.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say, I don't want to sing in the choir. Yes, mm-hmm. you will sing in the choir. Where is the happy medium there with when they can decide on how they're going to use their gift and when we decide for them, you will use that gift?
Somebody want to comment to that?
I heard my dad said, mm-hmm. one time I didn't want to do something, and he said that he felt that he would give me the free choice to do something after I'd have an experience, so I'd know what I was choosing from. Like, mm-hmm. in the sense that he felt like that I had a mind, and that I could certainly decide things for myself, but that it, as a kid, he never channeled, you know, put me in the choir and then put me at the Bible camp and took me these places, then I'd never have the chance to know, you know, whether I wanted to be there or not. And so I think the reason we were talking about it was it happened to be confirmation. I was in my confirmation. My pastor said, you know, all of you that are here that don't want to be here, why don't you just go home? And he said, how many of your parents would make you come back? So I went home to find out if I would have to come back. And I wanted to be there. My dad said that he wouldn't make me go through it, but he would have me be there. And then if I decided not to be confirmed or whatever, that was my choice, but the fact that you're there. So I don't know that he always felt that it was my talent to be in this play or that type of thing, but he just felt like the experience would be beneficial. I don't regret it. In fact, I'm really, to this day, I'm much more well-rounded person than a lot of people whose parents never make them go anywhere, you know, because they might have enjoyed it.
Well, discipline can be a gift. Pruning. You don't prune the vineyard, it produces milk. So, pruning is a gift.
Some others on that. I go through a lot of agony around, good agony, I mean, I like it. I mean, soul searching about why I want the kid to do it. And I find, especially when I was pastor of a parish, that I had to do a lot of checking out of, was this strictly for appearance? And then I was on very thin ground, I felt. And I wound up having to stand up for my kids' right to be kids, and not just for the appearance that was connected with my job. I tended to notice that the more I raised my voice, the shakier the ground I was on. So I would tend to check that out. You know, I was probably somewhat threatened by the thing. Judy,
all right, just for starters.
That worries me.
Say you have a parish. I'm just trying to imply in my
pretend
mind.
You have this friend that has a parish.
Pretend
okay.
Yeah. And if you're going to apply the concept, which I really like very much, that you use people's gifts, you don't say, we need a Sunday school, therefore, you teach Sunday school, you teach Sunday school,
mm-hmm.
You sing in the choir because you have a good voice. You teach Sunday school because, maybe you're a school teacher and you ought to be good at that. Instead of approaching it from that direction, and you go across parish,
mm-hmm.
and you look all over and nobody wants to teach Sunday school. Nobody wants to sing in the choir. Nobody wants to serve in the altar yet. I mean, just by chance, you could find a place where people in the entire group would find
right.
that their gift led to, you know, in a different direction. And yet, you and others around you feel, well, gee, we ought to have a Sunday school.
Mm-hmm.
There are kids running around this neighborhood who need Sunday school. They need that ministry. They need something
mm-hmm.
To receive something from the ministry of this place. And here, no one feels that that is their particular gift. Okay, how, you know, all right, then what do you do? Just playing the devil's advocate. Do you say, well, we don't have a Sunday school here because no one in this parish has gifts along those lines, or a Saturday school, or a weekday school, or whatever.
I'm really eager to talk about that. Are you folks, enough of you in congregations and so forth,
Do we need to
I've got 7 years of real good research on it. I have the answer, in fact. I always like to say that because people always say, well, there is no way. I always like to say, oh, I got it. And then I demonstrate that I don't. But that's your problem.
He didn't pay me to ask.
John and Mary, neither John or Mary are here, are they? Part of what was delightful about Washington, D.C. is that the Schramms were in this little new congregation where they did all these neat things with these neat people. And I was in this 150-year-old parish, which would cause me to go look at that, what they were doing, and say, wow, is that neat? We got to do that at our place. And find out 150 years is a lot of inertia. So I learned a lot of great things. And that's why I'm eager to, because I think a lot of us are in 150-year-old parishes, or at least they sometimes act that old.
Folks will say, let me just add to that. There will be folks saying, well, of course we have to have a Sunday school.
Right.
It's shameful not to have a Sunday school.
What's often happening in that is that that's really one version of why don't you and him fight? You know, it's like somebody who intends to stay out of the process is trying to control what other people are doing.
This person doesn't intend to stay out of the process.
Okay, then we got to start, see? Let's try two things, or a couple of comments. First of all, you have to be, if you're going to talk gifts in a congregational setting, you have to be committed to death and resurrection. There are a lot of things that die. Now, one of the interesting discoveries I had at this 150-year-old parish was that a lot of things needed to die. You know, we don't say, it's fascinating, one illustration. We started to move into this. And we said, if any of you are doing something that you resent, because that's a good kind of thermometer, resentment. Now, it isn't like I'll do nothing that causes pain, or I'll do nothing that's hard. You know, we're not talking fickleness. You know, I don't want to ever get my hands dirty. But resentment is a good thing to check out. You know, if I am continually doing this and continually resenting it, something's missing. And that's where I think I need to start getting serious about should I be doing this. Okay? We said if any of you are doing things you're resenting, and again, you don't do this in one meeting and all that, you're talking with each other all the way through. Well, one group said immediately, we don't have to go home and think about it. We resent it. They were the officers of the fellowship league, all four of them. They said, we resented having to take the job because nobody else would take it. We resent doing it. We resent the fact that nobody responds. We quit, you know, right then and there. And they quit. So we began to work on what was happening. Well, what we discovered is that the Fellowship League, which had done such a beautiful ministry, was ready to die. The Fellowship League was founded in World War II. When all these folks came off the farms of the Midwest to Washington, D.C., scared to death, nowhere to go, and they gathered every Sunday night, sang songs, went to dinner, and it was home, you know? And then they tacked on to that, doing all kinds of projects for the church. I mean, that was their fun. They would raise money, they would work on things, when I got to First Trinity, one of the first things people said to me is, you got to save the Fellowship League. You know, it's really in trouble. And I said, well, I'll certainly participate. And then they said, well, if you would just give us neat projects, that would save us. Well, I tried to give them a couple projects I thought were neat. I discovered they didn't think they were neat, you know, so I quickly backed out of saving the Fellowship League. When these officers resigned, we said, you know something? The Fellowship League was born out of a need which isn't there anymore. The war's over. It's been over for 20 years. And there aren't loads of single young people with the same kind of mindset. Now, there are plenty of single young people coming to D.C., but they aren't looking for any Fellowship League. I mean, they know what they want to do pretty well. And they're going some different routes. We said, now, isn't this funny? When a person gets old and dies, we don't say, what a disaster. You know? that person wasn't worth it, because after all, he may have done a few nice things, but after all, he got old and died. No, we say, thank God for the blessings we received from this person, and now we part company with great celebration. You know, we celebrate the life of this person. So we celebrated the life of the Fellowship League and buried it. You know, it was a very exciting kind of thing. That we didn't have to say, what, you know, the Fellowship League's a failure. Man, that was no failure. I mean, that was really something. But it was way beyond, you know, it was being kept alive by all kinds of support mechanisms, and we pulled them. we let it go. Sunday school, second one. Batch of the teachers said, we could really do about, the reason Sunday school teachers were talking, we need off in the summer, is that we're worn out. You know, we are pretty, you know, someone were saying, the problem with being a Sunday school teacher is the only honorable way out is to die. You know, and they didn't want to make that commitment because that's, you know, that's where it was. So we started to work our way through that, and Sunday school died in June. The next week, a fellow came forward and he said, I've been wanting to do this for years, but I couldn't break in. He said, I've had this project that I've always wanted to do. I've got about 10 neat movies that I would love to show kids and have them talk about. He said, would it be okay if I showed one movie each Sunday morning in the time that used to be Sunday school? And so he had this little project for the summer and showed kids movies. Much to the consternation of the Sunday school, because attendance went up and all that kind of stuff. And this neat kind of thing. Now, those are neat examples. I'm telling you the neat ones. There's pain. Man, is there a struggle. I made a commitment, a public one as pastor, that anybody who is genuinely saying no and is having people give him trouble at accepting the no, to call me. I would help the person say no. And that really changed a lot of things, you know. It said, if you need some moral support for saying no, call me. I think it's one of my jobs as pastor to help you withstand the committee. The second was a real, and that, the thing that a lot of people don't realize is if you help people say no, they get interested in their yes. You know, that's the part I think we're unwilling to trust. It's like, we have to be careful, because we tend to, you really got to be careful that you're not assuming that everybody is apathetic, lazy, uninterested. Those are probably some bad assumptions. Some people are apathetic, lazy, or whatever. And probably nobody is all of those. So we make this assumption that you got to control them, or they won't do anything. I can say out of my experience, it's not true. They don't do things that they don't have a ministry in. That's what they begin to sort out. And things tend to, there are things that go down the tubes. Okay, now how do you then operate positively? I'm sorry you triggered such a long speech.
That's all right.
For us, the positive thing is mission groups. This also is a Church of the Savior, Community of Christ concept, but we were able to rework that at First Trinity. We discovered that when people vote in congregations, that's basically a ridiculous process. Let's take an illustration. Five people get the idea that this congregation ought to operate a daycare center. Okay? Five people then go to the church council. And the church council hears the report, and being people of goodwill say, gee, I can't see anything against that, right? It's pretty hard to say you can't have it or whatever. And so the five people kind of show how it could work out. Church council says, okay, take it to the congregation. The congregation is up against it. And usually these five people are very eager. They're very, you know, they're very well respected in the congregation. They are good people. And now the congregation people are looking at that. And they're saying, yeah, this congregation needs a daycare center. These are good people. We believe it'll work. We vote for it. Now the five people are ready to set up their daycare center. And they go back to all those people who voted yes. And they make a discovery. nobody intends to work in a daycare center. Yeah. No, that wasn't what they meant when they voted yes. You see, all they did is gave official approval. They didn't say anything about that they were going to work in it or do anything about it. That's what's wrong with that whole voting kind of thing. You're getting official permission when what you need is help. You know, what you need is work. So we said, we're going to have to recognize that when there are policies involved, if those five people thought that starting a massage parlor is what the neighborhood needed, it might be the congregation would in fact need to vote on that. You know, it's you're talking policy, you're talking whether this fits the goals and purposes of the congregation when you're voting. But if you're talking getting something going, it works the other way around. Two people say, we really need a Sunday school, right? We are responding to our concern, our calling, to see to it that there is a Sunday school, okay? You come to the church council and you say, the three of us are very convinced that God is calling us to start a Sunday school, or to keep it going. As in the case of First Trinity, at the end of the summer, that became the question. Some people said, because this man quit, you know, he only had a three-month program, then some people began to say, we believe that God is calling us to deal with this Sunday school. Okay? They become, sometimes the original call is one person. And there are many things that one person can do without any group. You know, there are some mission activities that don't require the whole congregation, they don't require a whole group, just do it. You know, you bring that to the congregation saying, in the name of this congregation, this is the project. We had up in Winnemucca, Nevada, a young lady who was very frustrated with the congregation because they weren't getting involved in the ministry. The ministry was that she was, I forget what the specific activity was that she was doing with in a home for the deaf. As we checked it out, still, they only needed one person, and she was doing it. And we said, are you happy? Yeah, I'm very, very happy. It just frustrates me that nobody else, you know, is, again, in congregations, we often get the feeling that if people aren't involved in it, they're not supporting it, or they're not for it, or somehow I'm supposed to feel unhappy. So what they did is they commissioned her one Sunday morning to go do it for a year. And said, okay, you know, yeah, we do, really. We're glad you're there. You know, that's what it's about. Sometimes it takes a bigger group. And that bigger group then can become the calling group. And that's what happened with the Sunday school. Church council gives, let's say you find three other people that are responding as you are. You then have, let's say you put we always put a time limit. Let's say we give you 2 months to call people to the ministry of a Sunday school. And you have an outline of what it would take, but not in great detail. Your original idea is that if we had five people and $1,000 and Sunday morning, we could do the kind of Sunday school we have in mind. Well, that's what you then start saying. You get up in the worship service as part of the offering time and say, we'd like to call people to the ministry of the Sunday school. You know, and you put it in the newsletter. And you call some people on the phone. As long as they're aware they can say no, you've got a right to call. At the end of 2 months, let's say you have only three people and $500. You say, we cannot do it. And that becomes a very clear kind of thing. I personally think that's a better decision than running the thing along, building up resentment, struggling. Because maybe 6 months later, somebody will say, boy, I'm really sorry that didn't happen. You know, I'm ready to get in. For us, the value was putting a time limit, doing the calling during that time, and that's how the decision is made. You notice I said the money. I don't see anything wrong with people coming. You know, very often, people are very attracted to a certain kind of ministry and want to help pay for it. And maybe they don't have time for the Sunday school, but they want to see it happen. And they come forward at that moment. If you've got the basic outlines of what you need, now that mission group then makes a commitment, we're going to do the Sunday school for 1 year, or 6 months, whatever. At the end of that time, they reevaluate. Norm.
Just a little simple reaction. My track record of asking people to do serious things on the phone is very poor.
Sure.
It's almost a way of saying, I'm in a hurry right now. I want to call and ask you whether you teach high school for you. We've gotten in the practice of myself as a pastor and maybe superintendent of Sunday school, somebody going over and visiting with them for an evening. Here's what we want you to do. And don't say it's easy.
Yeah, right.
Don't say, well, it isn't going to take much time.
That's right.
It isn't going to take much of your commitment. Could you just squeak out this much time? Rather, people are much more impressed, I found. You say, this is going to be hard.
That's right.
And we really want somebody who's got a special talent. We looked at you. Well, maybe this is the reverse of what you began with. But we thought you would really be good at this. And at least some people say, gee, that's nice. Somebody thinks I can do something, you know. And they buy in at a deeper level.
No, Judy, that is precisely okay.
It is personal.
It is okay. As long as the person knows he can say no. I mean, that you're looking and doesn't... Now, again, you don't do that in 30 minutes. I mean, you don't say, you got to decide right now, but you do put a time to it. And it's a process of, I think, trying to give a little space for the Holy Spirit to work. If you never call anybody, there are all kinds of people who will never be doing it. That's true. I mean, Christ called. I mean, he didn't sit I'm using calling in that kind of sense. He said, follow me.
Do you have a lot of halfway projects?
What do you mean?
I just see you've got half the teachers, so then you decide, do we cut our Sunday school off halfway down? I mean, you can come up with three people only.
You can make that decision. We had a group that wanted to really take on a nursing home that was about 30 miles away. They had gotten very excited about that particular nursing home and the chaplain that was working there, and he needed a group of people to come on a Thursday evening. And again, they became the calling group. They got up to four. They had hoped that they would get like 20 people. They went back, they had five at the end of the period. They went back to the chaplain and said, this is what we've got. Now, what can five people do? And they negotiated that and they made an interesting discovery. Five people fit one car. And they had their transportation problem, which would have been a big hassle. They were able, and so they began to think carloads, and they said, if we put on another unit, it'll be another car. we'll do that. And it gets kind of fun. You know. So they had one carload, and those folks then got very... most of them had a job during the day. They got to where they met for a light supper and headed out to this nursing home. And it was really a nice experience. But they got off the kick of... We're trying to run a 20-person program. They said, okay, we can do that. One of the things with the Community of Christ, I remember they had in our area, they were trying to open up a clinic. And the person calling for that clinic, they needed doctors, they needed money, they needed equipment, and they knew they had a big project. And they weren't able to pull it off. But they didn't start it then either. They didn't start on a real limp. As they looked at what they were able to marshal, and they took about, I don't know, 3-4 months trying to put that one together. As they looked at what they were trying to marshal, and then what they had marshaled, they didn't have it. I think someone once said something about, no one goes to war without first counting the cost. You know? I think a lot of projects get wished on congregations by phonying the cost. You know, oh, it isn't going to be that bad. You know, that kind of thing. And people, because I'm the outsider in these retreats, people start to open up at the resentment they have. They feel they've been sold a bill of goods. And a lot of times they were right. You know, we didn't know it was going to involve all of this because that was played down in getting it started.
One feeling I have is that I feel like, okay, like I was a camp counselor for 2 summers, and then this year I came back to my congregation, and the pastor came to me and said, you know, would you like to teach Sunday school? And I felt like he was coming to me because I was a camp counselor and I was good when I was doing it up there, and so will you teach Sunday school because it's your God-given talent? I felt like I couldn't say, I almost couldn't say no, but I did because I'm that way. I didn't want to do it. The other thing is I felt like they were asking me to be a Sunday school teacher, but once I got there, I would have to do what they wanted me to do. And I think that a lot of times when we ask someone to give of their talents, we've already preconceived idea of what we're going to tell them they're going to do, you know, like what you're talking about. And I just feel like because it's easier, you know, we see someone with talent, okay, she works good with youth. So we call them to work with youth, and then we tell them how we want them to work with the youth. Well, then you're no good at it, you know, and you can't do anything.
Connie, that is just terrific, because so much of what goes on in churches, again, is that control thing. You know, I'm out of the process, but I want to make sure you do it my way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's really hard, and I came up here, and I wasn't even going to work with you. So I came to get away, I was going to work in the kitchen, and then they made a, you know, announcement that they needed someone to work with teens, and I had that chance where I could do anything I wanted. No one expected anything of me, because they didn't know anything about me. And I chose to do it, and I, you know, and I've enjoyed it this month. I couldn't have picked a better thing to work on, it was just the freedom to decide, and I think you do decide if you really have that freedom.
It's another thing about mission groups, is that when they've got the mission, you know, I like to think of mission in non-theological terms, like trade mission, bombing mission, whatever. It means a group of people sent out to do something. When they take off, they've got, there are some borders, but finally they're responsible. You know, they're going to have to be able to do it. And a lot of congregations are unwilling to let people take that responsibility. So they've got to have a right to blow it. And that's why I like the time. It's got to have a time limit. You know, if you're really concerned, you cut down the time rather than write in all kinds of suffocating things. You know, give them a 6 months or make an agreement for a year. And if at the end of the year you got to really talk about it, okay, go ahead.
As a parent, you can cultivate a child's gift. You maybe can mm-hmm. see that gift before the child does, and mm-hmm. you can maybe get them involved in things so they can recognize it on their own. I have a problem, and I find it very frustrating.
Okay.
Is with adults, maybe a mate,
mm-hmm.
how you can see a talent in that person, and I'm thinking of my husband.
Mm-hmm.
He plays the guitar beautifully when he is alone.
Mm-hmm.
And he finds it very difficult to use his talent in the congregation. And that frustrates me, because I think, especially me, because I have absolutely no musical talent at all. My greatest talent is being able to listen to it. Am I wrong in trying to cultivate him and try to move him into that circle so that more people can appreciate his talent? Or do I just leave him sit in the living room by himself and play? You know,
leave him alone.
You know, it's real. It frustrates me, because I know people would enjoy him.
It seems like we always give ourselves only two options. Mm-hmm. One is we make the decision he's got to do it, or the other is nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think in between is the option that if there's a particular thing you'd really like to ask him to do, you ask. But I would have trouble with your making the decision he's going to someday play in that. That's the kind of control that would really... Gordon Cosby says, how do I evoke the gifts of others? By enjoying my own. You know, that's one of the things I don't do, is make a decision somebody's going to use their gift this way. And to the extent you've made a decision that he would really be neat, he would really be for that, and all of that, I think you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
To the go ahead.
It has to do with a little bit of telling the truth about what's over here. It's not like you should do it,
mm-hmm.
or laying any kind of a burden over there. It's just that, you know, what I feel right now is I'd love to see you do it, and that's where I'm at, and I just want to let you know that, and it's absolutely up to you as to what you want to do.
Right.
Also, I would never dream of...
To me, your frustration comes in your decision that he ought to be doing.
I think my frustration comes in the fact that I can't do it.
Yeah, right.
You know? And I would really like to be.
You bet. I made an interesting discovery about myself in a lot of that. And back to Judy's, I don't want to be glib about death and resurrection. That's neat stuff up at Holden Village, and you get back
that's
and something
right.
cool.
I just decided to quit the Sunday school.
All right. Sorry.
That's good.
We had it.
I
have a little.
I've read it for 10 years. I'm just quitting now.
I was doing a retreat with the church council once, and we were into this. If there's anything you're doing that you resent, you know, good. And the church council en masse said, we quit. I was a church council. And being a trained group leader, I knew what to do. I said, let's break for lunch. Went over and apologized to the pastor. Said, you know, sometimes these things don't work out. And, you know, but I still expect my fee. But anyhow, what an interesting thing happened with that. Over lunch, you know, one way you examine a role you have is by getting rid of it. You know, you do that sometimes. You'll throw the role out and say, how do you feel without it? Well, apparently we had done a spontaneous role clarification, because over lunch, several of the people got to thinking about how much they liked being on the church council. So after lunch, we get back together, and this little timid hand goes up, and this person says, yeah, I'm a little hasty. They start to go around the room, and two people meant to quit. Not the whole group, two. The rest began to say, and you know what they said? You know, we have, for so long, we have bad-mouthed being on the church council, because that makes it seem more like mission. Like, if I don't want to be on this, I got to be on it, but I really don't want to. That makes it sound like I'm really sacrificing and all that. And he said, wow, it's no wonder we can't get people to do things, because we go say this negative thing and say, now, can you imagine Jesus saying to the disciples, I feel so sorry for you disciples, you know? I've got this massive project of saving the world, and I nailed you, but please be advised that for sufferers like you, how terrible it is, heaven is going to be great. No, he calls them together. And at least one way you could translate the Beatitudes is, you lucky people, you know? You're in on this thing. And notice how quickly, if somebody didn't want to be part of it, he said, hey, forget it, you know? And the church council, the whole goal, the result of this big retreat was simply, they said, we're never going to ask anybody from that kind of way again. We're going to tell them, first of all, that we are happy to be on the church council. We like this congregation. It's a good congregation, and we're very pleased. Now, we want to ask you to do this, and we want you to think about it. We think it's important. We think you've got the skills. But if you really see that it is not what God is calling you to do at this time, we'd really appreciate your saying no, because we believe in this thing. And you can almost see them stand a little taller as they walk. But they said, the thing got me is, we badmouth it because it looks like mission.
The thing I was going to say is, I was a layman in the church a lot longer than I've been a pastor. Mm-hmm. And I had a pastor who got the layman to do the asking. The church is still doing the calling, whether the pastor does it or not. And that's what I mostly follow.
Yeah.
Get the people who are involved in the council, who need replacements for the council, to go find the people who are willing to do that. Because they know what being a councilman is about. I'm talking from the pastor's point of view.
And that kind of attitude, they can often, you know, often the pastor is too
so they
defensive.
Don't think when I'm coming that I'm going to be asking them to do something, because I very rarely do that. Somebody
the pastor is so aware of the heaviness of that situation. You know, here you're faced with this kind of thing, and it's pretty hard. It is harder to say no.
Much harder.
Yeah.
Much harder.
Gordon Cosby, the little paragraph I often used to kind of get things rolling, was he made a little statement in a sermon. If there is anything that you are doing that you do not think you should be doing, quit. If the church, he says, if the church falls to pieces, so be it, because nothing else is going to help anybody. And I think that is absolutely true. In other words, you're not doing me a favor.
Kind of a paraphrase of what Gamaliel had to say about the disciples in Acts.
I don't...
Let him go ahead and talk.
I'm not real familiar with Gamaliel.
If God isn't behind it, you know, it'll fail.
But that's
anyway.
The one that usually gets the thing going, you know, to say, quit, because it's not going to do any good. And you may as well...
What's the name of this book?
It's not... The Cosby's thing, it's not in a book. It's in a sermon that he preached. And,
oh, dear.
Well... That was the good point. Just remember it. We'll see you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, for you too.